Here we go. Thanks so much for joining us. You're with The Ditch, our first episode of our series that we're doing with Red Wolf Media. This episode is brought to you by Centra's Chicken Fillet Rolls, because you know you're Irish when you love a chicken fillet. No, Centra wouldn't want to sponsor boys like us. You're with the three senior hurlers, myself, Owen McNeil, Roman Shorthall to my right, and Paulie Doyle to my left. How you getting on, boys?
Good.
Yeah, not bad.
Last week, we published the Attorney General's advice to government about two referenda down south about proposed constitutional changes, which were ultimately defeated by the electorate. Roman, do you want to talk us through what we actually published? We'll talk a little bit about the reaction to it, but with all these kind of things, I always find that the stuff about, you know, the reaction to what we publish and how we publish, it's kind of like parlor game shit. It's kind of the stuff that we kind of leave to the pollcores, who will write articles about senior sources in government. Or
yeah, very. And like, still, even now, like, that still seems to be kind of the general kind of crack with a lot of the papers about the leak. Like, that it's, you know, it's basically, you know, who leaked it. And, you know, it's just a lot of gossip. A lot of ministers as well seem to be kind of just angry about the leak, but there hasn't been as much kind of, you know, assessment of the actual substance of the advice, you know.
To go to the very start, because, look, the two proposed changes to the Constitution were defeated fairly roundly. I think that part of the reason why they were defeated in the manner that they were is that, you know, what were the actual changes about? So tell us about the actual proposed changes, and then we'll get into what the Attorney General said in his advice to government.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, like, the basically the Kerr Amendment proposed to take out any reference to mothers' duties in their home and, you know, protection in terms of kind of, you know, economic protection to kind of support those duties. It's never really been much of a help, like, I think, to mothers. It's always been kind of fairly aspirational, but it has been relied on a couple of times, and I think the Supreme Court, obviously, we're going to have a look at that provision again next month, and still will, because it hasn't been changed. And yeah, basically to replace that with, you know, a promise to strive to support
to
carers,
to or try our best.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not even endeavour.
The state
endeavor
always does that, though.
Yeah, it always tries its best. Or at least it says.
Say what
it
you want about the state, it always tries. Yeah. You always got an honest effort.
Exactly. And yes, and then you had the family referendum, which we were told or promised, like, was going to recognize a lot of different relationships other than marriage, including, as Micheál Martin told us, without question, single parents.
Sorry now, sorry. Yeah,
without
that
question.
That fucking line of is the, yeah. I'm sorry now. And, like, you know, usually comes with an interruption, you know, where he doesn't like what somebody's saying, and it's the very paternalistic, condescending, possibly with a raise of the hand as well. I'm sorry now.
Yeah,
you know.
yeah.
Without question.
Yeah, and I mean, like, listening back to that debate, like, I think it was Sarah McInerney that moderated it. It was on RTE early last week, and, like, it was just mad to listen back to it, because, you know, every issue that was kind of put to him, that was raised, that he kind of said wasn't an issue, you know, he basically lied. I mean, it wasn't the case that, you know, single parents were without question going to be included, because, you know, the Attorney General said that he couldn't guarantee that, you know, there was a strong argument, but there was no guarantee.
And on that, you've said lied, and, you know, even when we publish stories, not just about this, but about other things, you know, we oftentimes get into these debates about language, and we'll often talk about, will we say he lied? Or, you know, and obviously the dictionary definition of lie is to intentionally mislead someone, which is why, look, mainstream press does it, sometimes we do it ourselves, you know, sometimes it'll be, it's why you kind of will often come across these linguistic acrobatics where telling falsehoods or peddling falsehoods or telling mistruths, whether or not he lied or not, I suppose, yeah, possibly a matter of semantics or not, but to get to the Attorney General's advice, throughout the campaigns for both changes, there would have been references made to the legal advice that government has received. And similar to, off the top of my head, housing is a big one, where it's generally parties on the left, if they propose something like, say, a ban on evictions, or essentially anything that would work in favour of tenants at the arguable expense of landlords, you'll hear government say, oh, well, we've received advice from the Attorney General that that would be unconstitutional. Now, which, apart from anything, like, you know, all these things are matters of interpretation, first of all. Like, every piece of legal advice in stories like these, it's always a matter of interpretation. It's never just a black and white thing. And certainly, throughout the course of the referendum campaign, there were references made by government figures about the legal advice that government received. I mean, you've worked in the legal industry and you would have the utmost of respect for Alan Shatter, our former justice minister. I mean, he's an intellectual kind of idol of yours. You often say that. I mean, I kind of always have to, yeah, I get it. You love Alan Shatter and you want to emulate everything he does. You share his politics on every issue. That's really who you're about. Like, you're of Roman course, Shorthall yeah. and Alan Shatter.
Alan Shatter fanboy.
Yeah. You love him,
like. No, like, I mean.
But he said, see, to jump a little bit ahead, we published the Attorney General's advice, and sort of across the aisle, people said that it showed that government, as you said, mislead the public, lied. People like, you know, you had people like Alan Shatter, people like Michael McDowell, who tied himself up in knots about the source of the story. Anyway, people like Michael McDowell. Also, you had carers, people with disabilities, people on the left who are involved in disability advocacy groups. They would have said that what we published bolstered their case and showed that, yes, the government were selling carers and people with disabilities down the river. Do you agree with Alan Shatter that what we published showed the government lied?
You're just trying to force me to say that I agree with Alan Shatter.
But you agree with him on everything, though.
No, I think I listened to him, and this kind of, just to go back to what you said about, like, the Attorney General's advice just being an opinion, that is what it is. But the problem for the government is that traditionally and historically, they have always treated the Attorney General's advice as gospel. That's always how it's been treated, and it's often been used as well by ministers who are kind of backed into a corner. It's been used to kind of kick things to touch, or, yeah, as you said, like
progressive measures generally.
Generally, yeah, like progressive measures.
Broadly left measures. Yeah.
It's used to shoot them down, you know. And as we know, like, during the repeal campaign, the government did publish the Attorney General's advice. So, you know, it's not as if there isn't precedent for it, but it's always been the case that they publish the Attorney General's advice when it suits them.
I mean, how many times have they invoked it before and not published it? And I wonder, did the Attorney General even say what they claim he did in those particular instances?
Well, I mean, and this is it. And I think, like, this is what people may be thinking now. Like, you know, there's a question of trust.
Yeah.
You know, I think, yeah, I mean, basically what Alan Shatter was saying.
your friend Alan Shatter.
My friend Alan Shatter. he was talking to Barry Ward, who's, like, Alan Shatter is a lawyer, barrister, and, you know, almost felt sorry for him. Like, he was basically sent onto the radio to make a ridiculous and impossible argument. And of course, Alan Shatter just fucking destroyed the argument. And his argument was that, you know, the Attorney General's advice is just a, it's just an opinion, and governments are entitled to their own opinion. But like, that's not the way it works. Like, the government gets advice from the Attorney General and, you know, relies on that advice then to kind of put forward their legal proposal, their kind of legal interpretation of things like referendums. And, you know, those arguments don't wash, like, that, it's just an opinion. I mean, if that's the case, then we don't need an attorney general. You know, any minister can just hire a senior counsel to write them an opinion on a particular area of the law.
And with specific reference then to the actual advice itself, I mean, two different proposed changes, one of which was the Care Amendment, and you had people with disabilities, carers, and broadly speaking, people on the left who didn't like the terms that they saw of this proposed change, that they said, which all kind of hinged around this idea that the government would strive to support care in the home.
Yeah.
And there was a section in the Attorney General, in the Attorney General's advice, which, when we published what we published, that this was the first story that we published on the Thursday, we covered the fact that in sections of this advice, they were talking about the wording of whether government should strive to support care, whether they should endeavour to support care.
Yeah.
They also made reference to the Citizens Assembly had suggested take reasonable measures. Now, to me, take reasonable measures is the most material, like that you will actually do something. It's, yeah, you know, the least aspirational of all of them. And there was reference made to the fact that, oh, we're not going to fucking do that, like, you know.
Yeah, and yeah, it all boils down to money. I mean, that's all it comes down to.
And look, as is often the case, I mean, there was, you know, saw a little bit of commentary where people were saying, oh, and, you know, the yes side and the no side both claimed that this bolstered their argument, as if this was an interesting thing to say, where it was a fucking referendum campaign. Of course both sides were going to claim it as a win, because they do that with everything in every referendum campaign. Now,
a particularly deranged Green Party.
Yeah, they're the most deranged of all the deranged.
I think so, yeah. It's just a general observation, like, they're a lot of the stuff they say, and I'm not talking about green policies, I'm talking about just their general kind of demeanor and the way they conduct themselves. It's like they just live on another planet. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I can't remember the name of the is it Pauline, the Green MEP?
I can't remember her. She was quite vocal about
it. Yeah. Like, she was insisting that, and I think she's a lawyer as well, like, she was insisting that, yeah, isn't this great, like, for the S side? And, like, yeah, nobody else, like, thought it was great for the S side.
It was like you could track the various stages of grief based on, like, different politicians and their responses. So that one would be denial, right? Saying, oh, well, this is actually, this backs up everything we were saying, and this is a huge victory for the S side, right? You had anger, which was Mary Butler saying that, you know, this is an outrage.
Absolutely scandalous.
It's a scandal, yeah, that this advice was published.
Sorry, just to say, this is the Minister of State, the same Minister of State who's, like, her area that she's responsible for is our shambolic mental health services.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But for her, the leak was absolutely scandalous.
You had bargaining then, which is Lisa Chambers,
oh, yeah,
saying, you know,
I was
completely against this the entire time. And even though I was handing out those leaflets that said yes on them, I was really telling people to vote no.
And I was standing beside this, like, fucking gigantic poster that said yes, yes. What I really meant was no.
And then you had Roderick saying he was sad disappointed that this had happened, right? So now we just have to wait for when and see if when they all come back from their St. Patrick's trips to see if they've reached the stage of acceptance.
Which we're going to talk a bit about later on, actually. The big return. But yeah, so everyone kind of claimed this as it supported the arguments that they were making. Now, I mean, the state, and when I say the state, I mean, government-friendly media, the members of the ruling parties, and activists in the ruling parties, they kept referring to the fact that, and it did, look, it said it in the Attorney General's advice, that he referred to the fact that whatever wording was chosen, it would create a financial exposure to the state that, I think the word you used was very vulnerable people would be taking cases, which they would rely on these constitutional amendments if passed. Now, look, I mean, I kind of thought from reading through that those conversations were had going like, yeah, this is going to happen, but fuck, let's try to like limit our exposure as much as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as I said earlier on, it's always, all it boils down to is money. It's always been the case with, care and carers in Ireland. I mean, I think that's why this idea that, the government was really trying to do something to help carers here. I just think people would look at the reality on the ground and say, okay, you're forcing parents to drag the HSE to court just to get a 1.5 hour assessment of needs for their children. Like a very fucking basic thing.
Yeah.
And, then you have the stuff that people like Shane Corr exposed, gathering information on parents of autistic children to try and get them to settle cases. So like then this same state is saying, oh, by the way, we actually want to do something for carers by putting this into the constitution. And you'd had Heather Humphrey saying, this will strengthen my hand when I go to cabinet.
That was like, fucking rank, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty bad. It's fucking disgusting.
Dangling resources because it's a fucking in front lie. Of people like it's, a carrot yeah. on a stick. Like,
yeah. Resources that probably aren't going to come. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, she's the Minister for Social Protection. A lot of these rules around carers allowance and payments like that are made by regulations, which she can change overnight at the stroke of a pen. Do you know what I mean? It's secondary legislation. She can change it. So, I think, people just saw through the bullshit. And then the Attorney General's advice came out. And actually, something that was very interesting, which we've been talking a lot about and hasn't gotten much kind of, not a huge amount of kind of analysis from lawyers and academics, is the Irish language issue.
Yeah.
Where the word, there is the strive appears once in the Constitution, in a particular part of the Constitution. I think, was it Article 45? Or
Social
something?
Directives, isn't yeah. it? Yeah.
And the word that's used for strive is...
an start a yihil.
I'm glad you pronounced it because I wasn't going to fucking do it. I'll see. I pronounced the next one though. That's easy.
When my brother watches this, I'm sure he's going to pull me up.
I'm sure he'll be fucking texting you afterwards.
Hugh, that one's for you. Like, let's tell me how I did and be easy on it.
And what instead of using that, they were using a word called drain. Yeah. And what I found interesting was that because I asked you to ask your brother about it, or you were talking to your brother about it. He's, he's mad into the Irish language, and he was saying it means to, to climb a ladder or
yeah,
to ascend.
It's almost poetic aspiration.
Yeah,
aspirational language. Yeah, yeah.
And
to be clear, in the Attorney General's advice, he refers specifically to this, and he said,
yes,
just so you know,
yeah,
you're going to have in the English version, you're going to have the same word, right?
Yeah.
But in the Irish version, you're going to have the same word but two different translations.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
And the significance, of course, is that And because all the entire chat throughout the campaign was about strive to support, strive to support. But the significance of this is that if there's a dispute between the English and Irish language version in the constitution, the Irish language version takes precedence.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, I think it was a case that involved former minister Catherine Zappone 20 odd years ago, where she advanced some argument and it basically boiled down to whether an Irish word, if I recall it correctly, meant child or infant. So, and of course, the Attorney General, and that's his job, like, was pointing out, I mean, we don't know what discussions were going on, but what I do know is that Leo Varadkar in the Dáil actually used the expression in English, climb the ladder, which in relation to this provision, and that's not typically an expression someone uses in the English language, like when referring to something like that. So I think a lot of this stuff, yeah, I think there was an attempt to kind of pull the wool over people's eyes, you know.
Just actually, I like that you mentioned Catherine Zappone. Like, just unrelated to all of this. Like, Catherine Zappone, like, rarely has someone so inconsequential in the grand scheme of things just been such a bête noire for me. She's such a bollocks. Like. And, like, just sums up, like, you know, liberal hero, liberal icon, who went into government with one of the most, well, with two reactionary parties.
Yeah.
With them and all. I think people think of her as like one of the golden girls because she's like, she has a look about her and she's American.
She kind of, I think, is the type of person like that encapsulates this referendum. Like, it's just that kind of like, right on, like, this is, you know, we're going to take out, you know, sexist language, which it is sexist, you know, that, you know, people would accept that. But like, what people didn't accept is we're going to replace it with this fucking bullshit.
You know, I think like that Leo Varadkar interview where he said, like, you know, he doesn't think that care is the duty of the state, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, I do think that.
And
like, yeah, fine, you know, he's the, well, I was going to say he's just the leader of the country. But like, you know, I think it's fair to theorize that that was the kind of the ideological impetus behind a lot of this. I mean, like, the other thing is that, like, I personally most associate this, and fine, look, it's, as you said, it is explicitly sexist language. And I most associate the movement to get rid of that provision with Josepha Madigan. She's been calling for this since 2017, you know, and you know, she's someone, she made her name by opposing traveller accommodation in her constituency, completely unrepentant for it as well. Like, where, you know, she gave interviews to the Sunday Independent where she said, like, there's a quote in it going, like, you know, where I think she was asked, you know, would she support
Prime Mount Mary
the
real estate.
Prime Mount Mary, yeah, yeah. Like, would she support the state providing accommodation for travellers in her constituency? And her answer was, I live in Mount Marion, right? Like, and it's just like, and for me,
that was just her answer, wasn't it?
Yeah, I live in Mount Marion, right? That's it. Oh, sorry, forgot about that. Like, but like, she's been calling for this since, I went and took a look at it. Like, she's been calling for it since like 2017. And, you know, the year after Hillary lost to Trump, like, you know, like, and a kind of almost like that kind of identity-based bourgeois liberal feminism, which, you know, isn't really going to, like, not to be, like, don't get me wrong, I understand the inclination and I understand the people for whom it would be a meaningful, important thing to do, but like, we're not really talking about a material measure that would make most people's lives, you know, noticeably better. And, you know, at the same time, a real slap in the face to people who have to fight the state every step of the way for support, you know, people with disabilities and their carers.
Who 90 odd percent of whom are women.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So like, I think like, you know, it's important to remember as well that, you know, there were a lot of women that were looking at this, you know, because this is not just like an opinion. There was women saying this, like, that they were, you know, they were looking at this provision that says, you know, the state shall endeavor, blah, 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 economic necessity, and that, you know, that was going to be taken away and replaced with some fucking wishy-washy aspirational language. And, you know, a lot of women didn't feel comfortable with that. Like, you know, this is where, like, you kind of have to look below the surface, below the kind of, oh, you know, we're getting rid of sexist language, and look at, you know, what are the actual benefits to my fucking life, my very difficult life as a carer? Do you know what I mean? Like, what's this going to do for me, you know?
No. Why have a ref or two referendums that appear to most people to just be largely symbolic, you know, yeah, when there's so much inequality?
And maybe not even
at best they were symbolic. At worst, it was likely something more nefarious.
But like, we
at worst, me and Owen were you know, there were going to be inheritance issues because, you know, me and Owen just sitting here might have been in a durable relationship just by doing this podcast, you know.
But look, you know, we got the advice. We got it. You know, like when people, you know, ask, you know, it was on the Virgin Media Tonight Show, you know, and I was asked, like, the motivations of, you know, the means through which we got it.
It's not like, for us to speculate.
We can speak to our own motivation.
It's not a coincidence, it is a coincidence that, and I don't like people to think anything more about it, it is just a coincidence that Kate Middleton has disappeared around the same time that the Attorney General's advice was leaked.
And on that, stick with us. We've got a fantastic couple of guests coming to join us. We're going to have the Marchioness of Cholmondeley is going to be joining us to speak about ongoing speculation about the British Royal. So stay with us, and she's going to be joining later on. But Paulie, look, we got the advice. We did what we did with it. Can't put toothpaste back in the tube. What was your favourite reaction to what we did? I know Roman liked Alan Shatter.
Loved him.
It was the day before the referendum. We published a couple of stories. We published the advice in full. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the broadcast moratorium. But after the broadcast moratorium lifted and the mainstream press could report on all this, what was your favorite reaction to what the big bad bastards of the ditch did?
Or what was your favorite reactionary?
Yeah, your favorite reaction from a reactionary.
The one that's coming to mind is Mary Butler saying that it was scandalous, I guess, seemingly completely missing the point, you know, and the issues associated with this story. And you said it very well when you appeared on Virgin. You're like, if it was scandalous, it was a scandal that resulted from a previous scandal, which was them not publishing the stuff and misleading the public as to what it said, you know.
Yeah, this is, and Mary Butler, she was appearing on, was it The Week in Politics, or it was, or something like it, they're on the same RD. She was appearing on an RD panel show, said, yeah, absolutely scandalous, and she talked about how maybe places like The Ditch should be brought under this broadcast moratorium that applies to broadcasters who are governed by commissioned amount. They're not allowed to broadcast from 2 p.m. the day before a referendum.
Yeah, I mean, look, like what I would like, you have to get down to like, what would the point? What's the point of journalism if you get information like the information that we had, and you say we're not allowed to publish that? We'll just sit on that until after people have and like, voted.
But yeah, like, this is the thing.
What's the point?
But this is the thing, where journalists are the worst fucking people in the world for believing their own bullshit and hype and talking shit about their profession. Journalists. Well, I mean, there are other professions that can maybe rival them, but journalists fucking love being journalists, and they love saying
it's
shit.
It's all about
like,
procedure, though, and it's like it's particularly in journalists who write about politics, right? And that shines through in the writing itself, right? in terms of how that's always about, you know, someone in a suit going in and pressing a button and certain procedures for getting things done being in place, right? But then it also shines through in how they conduct themselves in actually doing their work. And there are set ways of doing things. One of these set ways is moratoriums in place, my hands are tied, can't say anything, even though they're fucking guidelines.
Yeah,
and it's like, not like, you know, it's...
to be clear, I mean, like, when you have a journalist kind of going like, oh yeah, like, you know, we hold power to account, you know, and we're the brave...
When we're allowed.
State. When we're, yeah, and it's like, going like, oh, but shit.
When our mommy lets us.
Right now, like, you know, the rules say we can't. And like, the thing is, right, okay, so let's talk about this broadcast moratorium. It was introduced, the principle of it, right? The principle is that it improves and enhances our democracy, that, you know, you leave voters alone for the last... you know, almost 24 hours
to read the
unless you're Leo Varadkar outside of school on the day you're voting.
Oh well, yeah, yeah, well, that's
yes, yeah.
But like, you leave them alone to kind of, you know, digest and, you know, think about all the arguments that they've heard over the last however long the campaign is, and then make more informed decisions. So like, the idea behind the moratorium is the electorate will be better informed. Now, to take that principle, we were the ones who acted in that principle. Like, because all of the broadcast journalists, and I will say people in Virgin Media and people in RTE primarily, they didn't follow that principle. They just followed rules. Like, where, like, they just said, oh, well, we can't do it. Like, you know, and it's kind of like, and as Roman has pointed out, there were certainly ways that journalists in RTE and Virgin Media could have covered it if they wanted to.
Yeah, and I asked Commission Naman for confirmation on that yesterday. It's there in their guidelines, but I just want to hear it from them. Like, RTE and Virgin could have put a video online, could have put a video on Twitter. RTE could have published a story on their website if they wanted to. It doesn't apply to online audiovisual material.
But they didn't want to lift the nerf. Like, you know, it's just, yeah, like, what is the point? Otherwise, you have this, and yeah, not, we won't believe our own hype, but we'll just go and, you know, with what other people have said. You know, Lisa Chambers, Fianna Fáil senator, who is, she's struggling. She's not doing too well right now.
But it's not even just that, though. It's three former ministers for justice saying that the electorate was voting on false pretenses.
Yeah.
Right? We had information that demonstrated that. We're going to sit there with our arms folded and say, no, we're not allowed to do that because it's against the fucking guidelines.
It's
nonsense. Bullshit.
And I think when you were on Virgin... very serious former broadcaster Sean O'Rourke. He's an institution. The way he was going on, I think he said to you when you said like we'd ignore the moratorium if it applied to us. What he said like so the law doesn't.
So you're above the law.
So you're above the law then. I don't know. Like did he seem to think like it's a criminal offence or something? I don't know.
Just a kind of a stupid fucking thing to say. Like where it's like we'd consider like I'm not above, under, or beside us. We'd consider it and we'd do what we were going to do. You know. And like
he was certainly above the COVID regulations when he went down to Clifton.
Just about allowed back on the telly now to talk about.
He's been rehabilitated.
Paulie, you published a piece. It hasn't been up online yet. This episode, we're coming to you the day after Patrick's Day. The state's opposition parties, our parties of government, they'll have had their trip over to DC for St. Patrick's Day. Would you say that this is part of our special relationship with the US? Something that you wrote about for the Ditches print edition that we published last year.
Yeah, so the special relationship broadly refers to, I suppose, cultural connections between Ireland and the United States, and then also a certain affinity that a lot of Americans would have for Ireland and vice versa. But it's mostly just pageantry, and what's actually happening is that Ireland is a strategic asset to the United States, and we're also economically subordinate to it, right? And this comes to a head once a year when senior politicians from both government and opposition go to the White House to break bread with whoever's in charge, hand them a bowl of shamrocks and get a bit of a pat on the head, you know. I think it's quite an unedifying spectacle at the best of times, and we're kind of prostrating ourselves in the hope that American multinationals won't leave, that we've based our economy on around won't leave the fucking country if we pose for a photo. But it's in particularly bad taste this year, in light of everything that's happening in Palestine at the moment. Joe Biden is arming a campaign of genocidal violence. And we have politicians, in a rather disingenuous way, saying that the best thing that they can do for Palestinians is actually to go over and to do a photo op with this guy.
Just actually on that, we'll come to the politicians, but as I often say, someone once said that imperialism is the highest form of capitalism. Did you see the picture of Fergal O'Rourke with Kennedy?
No, I didn't see that.
Fergal O'Rourke, former managing... He's a former managing partner of KPMG, isn't it? He's not still, I think.
Is he the chairperson or something of the IDA now, or Enterprise Ireland or something?
Certainly a one-time managing partner of KPMG. This is a guy, Fergal O'Rourke, Fredo O'Rourke, no, in fairness, as far as Fredos go, he's pretty decorated himself.
Is Joe Kennedy the guy who said, he tweeted out something like, no one in America should have to face medical bankruptcy without a lawyer?
But you know, Fergal O'Rourke, former managing partner of KPMG, the man who is, and he loves this as well, by the way, like, he is the man most closely associated with Ireland's status as a tax haven. Now, he would argue that it's not a tax haven, but he's the guy who wrote, you know, all these things that, you know, the double Irish with a Dutch sandwich and the, what is it, the Dutch malt, was it as well, or the something malt, or the single malt, was it, or something? All these different tax avoidance structures. Fergal O'Rourke, the man most associated with them, always maintains that Ireland isn't a tax haven. Others would say differently.
They come here for our highly educated English-speaking corporation tax rate.
But see, the funny thing is, I mean, like, there are schools of thought. I think it's Conor McCabe maybe has written about this. He's a great Irish writer. That in the early days of Ireland introducing these, you know, things from the corporate tax rate to these, you know, would you call it a business environment that would encourage tax avoidance, whatever, you know, all that bullshit that people say about Ireland being, you know, an English speaking country in Europe, highly educated workforce, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. Like, all that stuff is actually true. And there is a school of thought that says that these American multinationals probably would have come here anyway. Now, whether they would have stayed or not is
this another. Is in the '60s, like in the Lamas era.
They would have come, like, you know, but then they were like, oh fuck, we don't have to pay any tax either. Like, you know, that we kind of, it was an incredible like underselling of Ireland. But I mean, and it's funny that you should say about the IDA. The IDA, I fucking love guys who love the IDA.
One of those guys you're talking about recently said, what was it they said?
Didn't Roland McGreevy get all misty-eyed on the IDA's anniversary?
Yeah, I think he said, like, they're the envy of the world.
Envy of the world, The IDA, the Irish Development Association, this is a, you know, the state agency most closely associated with what we call foreign direct investment, the American multinationals who are all here, they kind of just give an acceptable sheen to all this tax avoidance because they're the ones who supposedly bring these companies in here and bring the jobs. And so, like, when, you know, pick one, whoever it is, like Facebook or something, have jobs to announce, it'll be the IDA executive will do the photo op because... can't have someone from, like, you know, my take on all this is that the IDA do fuck all as far as this goes, and it's actually it's the tax advisors in the big four, Fergal O'Rourke and his ilk, who actually bring these guys in. And then you have to be honest, you have some guy from the IDA in a blue suit and his brown shoes, you know, there for the photo op, going, yeah, "Oh, welcome to Ireland," you know, like. And but you have Fergal O'Rourke there. He's obviously, yes, you have politicians over for the St. Patrick's Day jaunt, but then I thought it was interesting to see Fergal O'Rourke there as the, because, you know, this is, it is all an economic thing. It does all come back to.
Do you not think, like, that the IDA guys, they go over there and, you know, they say, right, we speak English? And then when they're trying to, like, convince them to come, hang on a second, just hang on. Take a look at our leaving cert.
Yeah.
Have a look at it. Look how good it is.
Yeah.
And then, like, when they're just about to walk away from the table, like, they're like,
it's just like, you come to Ireland.
But have you seen our junior cert? It's really good. You know, we're really educated.
Yeah, you know.
The Facebook executives, like, you know, these top fucking lawyers and accountants are like, fuck yeah, let's go, let's do it. You know, it's nothing to do with the tax rate. It's
pretty
just
sweet,
like,
deal. Like, you just come over, you set up, you don't pay any tax, and all you have to do is call someone an IDA, and then if you happen to be creating a few jobs, they get to announce it.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the trade-off.
I have a friend who used to work in Google, and, you know, he would talk about how, you know, first of all, in as much as, you know, it's relevant in some regards, you know, when you do have senior politicians announcing however many, they'll announce jobs that often never materialize. That's another.
We did loads of stories.
We've done stories about this, you know, fake jobs, fake job announcements. The jobs that do materialize, oftentimes what you're talking about are, you're talking about mainland Europeans, actually, from that kind of belt of elite European business schools who come over and fill these positions. They sort of live siloed away in very expensive apartments down the docks, and they'd be there for as long as their contracts are, you know. But a friend of mine was he used to work in Google, and he said that one day there was a bit of hubbub around there. And this is another part of it as well, by the way. A lot of these companies, they will employ people as contractors rather than, so, like, you'll have, you know, someone like CPL or whatever. It gives an extra level of, well, protection to the companies involved. It allows them to kind of get around certain employment law measures where they're not directly employing these people, but they'll employ them through an employment agency like CPL. And there is apparently lots of mainstream press have kind of written about this divide in these multinationals between the full-time staff and the contractors. Yeah. This friend of mine was a contractor, and he said that, you know, he was on his desk and there was a bit of hubbub around, and, you know, you can ask someone like, somebody was saying, we have a visitor here, you know, and he was like, who is it? Like, and he goes, and if somebody, you know, from one of the fucking Scandinavian countries, I suppose, going like, you know, they're saying he's the Taoiseach? It's like, you know, and right enough, it was Varadkar, like, you know, and somebody had to go, like, you know, you're like, what is this word? Like, you know, and then it was explained, you know, oh, it's the Prime Minister, right? And apparently then when the word Prime Minister was said, like, you know, there was all the European full-time staff, like, the Prime Minister's here, like, and they were like, and then somebody said, no, it's the Prime Minister of Ireland, ha. And they all laughed and went back to their desk. Couldn't give a fuck, like, you know. But I do think, yeah, that, I mean, you talk about Ireland, yeah, being a tax haven, and, you know, going over, prostrating yourselves in DC for Patrick's Day week, other parts of the US. To me, it betrays a fundamental misunderstanding of the dynamic of that relationship, where I actually will say, you know, take it as you want it, arguably in the Irish state's defense, I actually don't think we're a tax haven proactively, right? I think it's a reactive thing. I think first of all, if you look at any of the major tax havens across the world, almost all, with just off the top of my head, with the exception of the Netherlands, which wouldn't be a tax haven to the same degree as Ireland, arguably, but like classically, all of the tax havens around the world are former or current colonies. It's a form of financial domination, effectively. And Ireland is, to be very reductive about it, Ireland is a tax haven because foreign capital wants us to be a tax haven. And that's where the power lies. And we don't actually need the IDA to go over and sell Ireland in the way that it does, because I would be firmly of the opinion that foreign companies are getting a whole lot more out of this arrangement than the Irish state is. Now, yes, we are, depending on which economist that you listen to, yeah, we are to varying degrees reliant on these corporate tax receipts now, but still, we're giving away a lot more than we're getting back in return. Now, to come to the other part of the Patrick's Day trip, Leo Varadkar says that he believes in his heart that Joe Biden, he believes that Joe Biden's heart is in the right place, is what he said.
Was his heart in the right place when he was like licking a giant ice cream cone talking about how the genocide will continue?
Yeah.
Where the fuck was his heart when he did that? Like, what is he even... Is that some sort of a health concern? He's making sure that Biden's heart is still in his chest cavity in the right location because he's 200 years old.
I mean, it's a stupid thing to say, apart from anything, like, you know, his heart is in the right place. You know, like, this is when I get real, like, pedantic, like, where is his heart there, like, you know. I also then thought that, like, again, to not to get caught too much up in the semantics, like, Varadkar's choice of words, he said, I believe. Now, he doesn't believe that, does he?
I think that he actually, it's very hard not to get the impression that the politicians are actually going to Washington to try and undo the small amount of reputational damage done by them making the mealy-mouthed statements about Palestinians having humanity that they've already made, right? And, you know, I think actually they probably do know what's going on here, and they feel like, you know, their hands are tied. We're just going to have to play ball. They've kind of made their peace with it, and they're just going to do it.
Is there, I mean, the possibly the, you know, one comparison that can be made, to kind of arguably one of the starker differences, Sinn Féin, SDLP, one's going, one's not. What's their,
I'm conscious of the fact that we're in, we're just off the Falls Road. So I think we're going to say Finn Shane.
Well, there were two messages. On the one hand, you had Michelle O'Neill saying that, like, this is the strongest position that we could possibly take to advocate for Palestine. It just so happens to also be in our interest. But then the Business Post covered it. Actually, when Gerry Adams was at some sort of a meeting, there were journalists present, so he must have known that this was going to be published. He was a little bit more candid, and he said that Palestinians will understand that we can't set back our own liberation struggle in expressing solidarity with them, which is another way of saying we've gone pretty much as far as we can, and it's too costly for us to go any further. So I don't know. You know, maybe that was a way of trying to placate people who were upset about it, or maybe they just weren't consistent in their messaging. It's difficult to say. I don't think they should be going, personally. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I aside from the actual specifics of this situation, I'm like, what makes me uneasy is that, like, all right, okay, so I understand. Look, despite what anyone in Sinn Féin says about why they're doing it, I think that it's, you know, it's to advance the cause of Irish unity. I understand that inclination. What would make me uneasy is that, like, all right, okay, so what does history tell us about nationalist movements that the US gets behind? You know, I mean, like, Augusto Pinochet in Chile, the Contras in Nicaragua. Like, these are the, I'm really skeptical about the emancipatory potential of a nationalist movement that needs to be rubber stamped by the US. You know, you can, I mean, a more contemporary example, you know, you'd wonder the Hong Kong pro-democracy movement, which is a broad church. There are certainly, there are members of the left that are involved in that movement as well. But, you know, you also wonder, okay, what does the National Endowment for Democracy have to gain from backing this movement? Why are US senators meeting with the movement? What's in it for the US? So it makes me kind of uneasy when I see, like, yeah, fine, like, let's advance the cause of Irish unity, but what kind of unity is it going to be? What kind of state is Ireland going to be if it's a unity, if it's a nationalist project that is rubber stamped by the US? You know, I kind of, there was a British propaganda poster during the 60s. It gets shared relatively regularly online. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's a map of Ireland and Britain, and the headline is something that is like, Ireland, Britain's Cuba, ? And it was because of, you know, I think this would have been published during the 60s or 70s. Well, yeah, I think this was during the 60s and 70s, when certainly during the civil rights campaign, during the conflict, there would have been, again, a broad movement as well. There would have been, you know, there would have been leftist elements, Marxist elements of that movement, and there would have been in the British establishment, there would have been a fear that, oh fuck, like this could be our Cuba, like, you know, a 32 county Marxist Republic. We can't let that happen, you know. Now, I'm not saying we need to be Cuba, but I'm saying, like, you know, it's related to what we've said about Ireland as a tax haven. Ireland under the dominion of foreign capital. It's sort of like, if we need the US to help the cause of Irish unity along, what is that state going to actually look like, I think?
Probably like the one that we have now, but on a 32 county basis.
And yeah, look, speaking then of
I think it's just about money, you know? Yeah. Fundraising and stuff like that.
Speaking of free statism and Irish sleeveens, Micheál Martin and the publication of the Canova Report, which was last week, it was a report into a British agent in the IRA, how do we say it? Like, you know, Freddy Scappadici always denied he was steak knife. Lots of people say he was. This report, he was known as the jewel in the crown, I think, of the British intelligence and security state. This agent was, he led what was known as the IRA's Nutting Squad to root out informants. This person was an informant himself. The British press, the BBC and The Guardian, The Guardian in particular, I think, referred to how victims, or the families of victims who were murdered, in which this agent was complicit, effectively blamed the British state, and they think that the British state was complicit in these deaths. This was certainly the tone of British coverage in the London Independent, the BBC, the Guardian. The British state has something to answer for here. Its agent is complicit in these murders. Our Minister for Foreign Affairs, Micheál Martin, what do you think he leads with?
Whatever makes the IRA look bad. I mean, yeah, like, it was all, it's all fucking shit stuff. Like, it's never going to be, there's never going to be anything kind of positive in a report like this. You know, it's, we're talking about death and, you know, the legacy of what went on up here where we're sitting now. And yeah, I think, like, you know, anyone reading it, and like obviously any even British journalist that was reading it, you know, was able to write, I think, a reasonably objective kind of analysis of what it was all about. But Micheál Martin, you know, I mean, that's if you look at kind of how he's dealt with you know, atrocities on different sides in the past, it's always been, you know, there's always an extra layer of outrage when he's talking about the Provisional IRA, or, you know, he just doesn't have that kind of disgust and outrage when it comes to atrocities carried out by the British state. And you could see that in his tweet, because it was very much, yeah, there you go, I was right, the IRA killed the most people. And then he goes into his second tweet and he's like, and it's quite clear that there were some British agents as well, that, you know, there was a dereliction of duty. Do you know what I mean?
Like, why do you think that is? Like, we're like, well, like, why does he react like that?
It's politically advantageous, for one. I mean, he contorts himself in the Dáil at every opportunity to bring up the IRA. I remember Mary Lou.
He has a particular facial expression, doesn't he?
Yeah. But she was talking about corruption and the Galway tent, and he was like, you corrupted life on this island with your advocation of political violence. So there now, right? Just completely, like, if you want to talk about the conflict or the legacy of it, like, you can do that. But there's a tendency to try and just jab it into, you know, context in which no one was talking about it, as a way of deflecting criticism. So I think it's primarily out of self-interest. The other thing would be, I would say Micheál Martin genuinely believes that he is opposed to political violence, right?
He's a noxious free stater, actually.
Well, here's the thing, though.
It's certainly politically advantageous. I think he also believes that.
But unless you're a pacifist, you're not actually opposed to political violence, because the way things are now, the distribution of wealth and power is sustained by violence or the threat of violence. And that's the problem with people who moralise about this, is that they never actually acknowledge the force that is used to keep things in place the way that they are. Instead, we get things, we get people saying, well, yes, there's a housing crisis, but what about the IRA, you know? Or you get Aidan O'Riordan, someone, Mary Lewis, again, was talking about child benefit, and he said, oh, Jean McConville could have used it. And then never mentioned her name again, because that's how much she cares.
It's unbelievably crass, but for
her name, like, gets thrown out a lot.
It's deeply cynical.
Know, not as much now, like, they use other different things now, like, but yeah, in the past, like, there was a kind of, like, her name was in fashion for a while, where you'd have people, like, just in the Dáil saying, oh yeah, Jean McConville, but, like, they didn't actually give a fuck about Jean McConville. It was just like,
no,
I just want to have a go at Sinn Féin, so I'm just going to fire her name out there. I mean, that's,
so it's, yeah, it's self-serving and opportunistic, but also I would say in Micheál Martin's case, he probably also believed it.
Yeah, I mean, like, free staters, like, and that kind of, yeah, free statism, which is a political ideology, I think, like, you know, there's a certain contempt for Northern nationalists, I think, and Micheál Martin is a particularly flagrant offender of that.
More people need to, was it the GAA need to encourage more people to join the PSNI?
The coroner here is calling for an inquiry into the murder of Sean Brown, who was he was chairperson of a GAA club in Derry, abducted and assassinated by, I think it was the LBF. This was in the mid-90s this happened, and the coroner this month is calling for an inquiry into Sean Brown's death, because there is a lack of information, basically, for him to actually carry out an appropriate inquest. And it is quite clear that there was British state involvement in Sean Brown's assassination.
Or, as Micheál Martin would say, a dereliction of duty.
Yeah. But Micheál Martin's answer to this is, like, when he talks about, and yeah, because he is, Micheál Martin, he's a good GAA man. Like, you know, he wants the GAA to encourage its members to join the PSNI.
I mean, like, even more recent scandals, wasn't there that incidents where officers in the PSNI took photos of a man who'd killed himself and put him in all of these degrading positions, and were laughing at him because he was from a Catholic or a nationalist background?
Yeah.
And we're supposed to be encouraging people to Join this org. Join up this organization.
We're going to go into what's going to be a weekly segment, Take of the Week, brought to you by Lion's Tea and Tato Crisps, because we all love being Irish. Oh, oh. Paulie, what's the Take of the Week?
The Take of the Week this week comes from the most sensible man in Ireland, Mr. Pat Leahy.
Any sensible man.
The most sensible most of all, sensible, yeah, yeah. Which is Pat Leahy in the Irish Times. Got quite a bit of traction this week. And the headline is, as the EU prepares for war, Ireland sticks its head in the sand. In fairness to us, we really have some neck. There is literally no end to our chutzpah.
Was this ghostwritten by Bridget Laughlin?
And it's more or less lamenting the fact that we are not tooling up quite as fast as some of our European counterparts to escalate the possibility of nuclear war, because that's what mature and sensible and respectable countries are doing. Well, let's have a look. I do not... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I know, I read it there earlier, and, you know, one of the things, one of the points included that really kind of, it always grinds my gears when I hear this, like, of, you know, we need to get real here, right? Okay, and it's, you know, and they talk about defense spending, like, where, oh, look, in Ireland, you might as well give €1 billion to the fucking FCA, like, really, if we're being real about it. But, like, he says, yeah, oh, we need to get real here because, you know, people talk about... He says something about, oh, yeah, how the pro-neutrality crowd always get up on their high horse.
The pro-neutrality lobby.
Nobby, yeah, thing? Yeah. Get up on their high horse about possible NATO membership and Ireland joining NATO. And Pat Leahy and others like him will say, we need to get real here. NATO would never have us because we don't spend enough. Like, now, that to me is horseshit. NATO would absolutely have us. They just want members. And
we just had the head guy from NATO over
yeah,
here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you think NATO would come here for our highly educated
workforce? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's,
yeah.
So much of the stuff that's the way neutrality is written about, it's difficult not to just see it as the power fantasies of men who are in their 40s and 50s. Yeah. They're just kind of like, I remember when, you know, stuff, there's stuff like, oh, well, like, if Vladimir Putin was here, I would punch him square in the face. So I would. I would fucking batter him, right? Yeah, yeah. And so I'm actually, you know, to come back to Palestine, if you look at the way, the difference in the rhetoric that we that Ireland use in terms of talking about, look, saying we should support, you should have a principled opposition to people or to imperialism. You should support the right of people to resist invasion and occupation, right? But if you look at the way, there are ways of doing that as a neutral country by facilitating dialogue and trying to basically, you know, if you're dealing with people who have nuclear weapons, the first priority would be to make sure that they're never used. Right, but Pat Leahy doesn't think that. He thinks that we need to just buy a load of weapons and get in line with the rest of the guys because Europe is preparing for war. And that's
but
what
he's not going to go, though.
And they're laughing at us over in Europe. Did you know that? When I go on a press junket to Brussels and I go out for dinner paid for by the European Commission, the people from AP are going,
You Irish.
You are not a serious man. And I think your son should go to war. So when I go there, I can feel like a big man.
Is the proposition like that if we pumped another couple of million into our defences that, you know, if Russia was to invade Ireland, that we'd actually stand a chance? Is that it? Like,
that's what Ben Tonner thinks, maybe.
Is that what they're saying? Like,
there's so much cynicism, though. Like, if you look at the Irish Defence and Security Association website, it's like, the global security situation is deteriorating. Democracy is on the brink. Climate catastrophe is going to completely fuck the world over. But if we act now, we can make money.
I know a man who sells a few drones.
It's so deeply cynical and fatalistic, or even arguably nihilistic, the way that these people are going on.
But like, it's also as well, it's this, you know, the general tone of these people is always, we need to get real. And, you know, people like us aren't serious. Like, these are the biggest fucking pub talkers going. Like, you know, that we need to...
The fixation on not appearing childish is itself puerile. It's just a... All of these columns are a fancy way of being like... Look, Daniel McConnell will be like, you're not a baby, are you? The business foe's view. Anyone who doesn't support joining NATO is a baby. Is a child.
One of the problems, and you kind of have touched on as well with these people, is that, you know, this kind of talk not began, but it certainly intensified around the time of Putin's invasion of Ukraine, right? Now, look, people occasionally talk shit about us, but you can go and you can look at our record. One of our last stories was about a company based in Ireland who has been named by the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry as a supporter of the war. It's a company that's
an ideological supporter of the war.
This is an oil company based in Dublin. You wouldn't have known about it if it weren't for the ditch.
Nobody touched it afterwards.
Company audited by KPMG to get back to the economics of it as well. But like, you know, what we think about the war in Ukraine, it's a matter of record. What I will say is, what you've said about how you have to have a principled kind of uniform approach to these things. The problem with a lot of these guys is that Russia-Ukraine happened, and it was so fucking easy for them. It was easy for someone like Micheál Martin to go, I think Putin is evil, actually, is the word I would use. Like, it was so easy for him. You can play the big man. You can also see...
He called parts of the word genocidal as well, which is a word he will not use now.
It was so easy as well for you can see, not to be one of these guys, but like, you know, you see the guys on Twitter, it's their first time engaging in... anything like this, like a story of this, going like, what? You're telling me there's a war on? This is bad. This is bad. And they put a Ukrainian flag in their bio. So easy for them, because there was generally, like, there's, again, parties on the left in Ireland, Sinn Féin and PPP, they get a lot of unfounded criticism about their positions on Russia, Ukraine. It's a matter of public record. They oppose the war. They oppose Putin, you know? But like, what's hard now for people like Micheál Martin, people like John O'Brien, the Maynooth academic, people like Bridget Laffin, Chancellor of UL, current Chancellor to be Chancellor of UL, these people who really went in heavy on this kind of thing around Russia, Ukraine, and then. What made things difficult for him now is what's going on in Palestine.
To be fair, I'd agree on Bridget Love on what you've said. Like about, but John O'Brien
has been good on
Gaza. He's actually, I would say, an exception to the rule because in general, a lot of these people, Bridget Laughlin types, don't seem to give a fuck about what's going on.
If you don't have a principled opposition, you know, to imperialism or in, you know, countries being invaded, what you're left with is just picking sides between goodies and baddies.
You're left as a Western chauvinist, really, you know.
That's pretty much it, yeah. So a lot of these guys are is just kind of Europhiles and chauvinists, and it's Western values. Or, you know, they're like, Ukrainians are like us and we need to protect them, not like those people in Gaza.
But your people have, like, the people you're talking about have said things like it's just good versus evil.
Yeah.
You know, but fucking
tumbleweed. Which is like for all the invocations of maturity is how a fucking 7-year-old thinks. Like,
yeah.
There are goodies and baddies, and we're the goodies, and we need to fight with the good. You're not a baby, are you?
All right, guys, what a first week of it. Thanks so much for staying with us. On that note, levels of maturity. We hope we've surpassed your expectations of maturity. We'd like to apologize to the Marchioness of Cholmondeley. We ran out of time. Hopefully we'll have you next week. And hopefully you stick with us for what's going to be a nice little series here in collaboration with Red Wolf and the Dutch. Thanks so much, guys.